Welcome to this podcast from the Royal College of General Practitioners. My name is Sally Higginbottom and I'm a GP in Camden. Today I'm interviewing Dr. Claire Wadlow, a consultant psychiatrist working with the Old Age Community Psychiatry Team in Enfield, North London. Hello, Claire.
Hello, Sally.
So today we're discussing Alzheimer's disease, the commonest form of dementia. What I thought might be helpful is for us to talk through a typical trajectory for an older adult with memory problems, making use of Claire's specialist knowledge. So, Claire, it's quite common for someone in older age or even middle age to ask us about dementia prevention and brain health. What would your advice be on preserving good brain function?
Well, Sally, the old adage is definitely true here that prevention is better than cure, because as most people know, very unfortunately, there's still no cure for dementia as yet. However, there is lots that people can do to protect their brain and keep themselves active and engaged as much as possible. So all the good advice that I reckon you GPs are giving folks about their physical and mental health applies here. The phrase I often use that people can relate to is anything that's good for the heart is good for the brain. Thinking about things like physical exercise, very simply, getting off the bus a stop or two earlier, trying to keep up those three or four times a week of brisk walks or swims, anything that they enjoy, making sure they're cutting down or stopping smoking as soon as possible, reducing alcohol intake, educating people about the recommended weekly allowance, which is always much less than you think it is, and thinking about diet are all really important.
That's great. Thank you. And in terms of social function, I understand that's quite an important contributor.
Absolutely. Yes. I know there's people think about doing a Sudoku a day or a crossword is good for you. And sure, it's not bad. But the very best thing really we find, and I tell my patients, is to keep socializing, to keep engaging with others, family and friends. I know that's been particularly difficult recently. But the more you can get out and meet people, particularly in groups, it's great exercise for the brain, because you have to remember who's broken their leg recently or whose daughter got married and what's been happening. And I think people find that being able to monitor a conversation and join in and respond to all those conversational cues is such good practice for the brain. So we're forever encouraging people to get out and about, join a club, whatever they like, book clubs, art groups, walking groups, to keep busy.
Lovely. Thank you. And anything in terms of sensory deficits?
Yes, absolutely. There's been a really interesting study actually repeated last year, commissioned by The Lancet, led by Prof. Jill Livingston et al., which has looked at 12 modifiable risk factors of dementia. And one of the most interesting findings they've had from that study is that hearing deficit in middle age has shown itself to be a significant risk factor for dementia. So correcting your hearing. And that, look, makes sense to me. If you can't hear what's being said, what you're being told, how are you going to remember it, for starters? And it's about being able to engage in those social groups that we were just talking about. But equally, having a good eyesight, good hearing will help people stay engaged in their day-to-day.
Excellent, thank you. And of course, often older age brings about big changes in life. Any advice on those?
Yes, of course. I know I see a biased population of people, because the people that come to us are often the ones having difficulty. But going through retirement, for example, is a big change in somebody's way of life and their social interactions. So having some thoughts given to it, preparing for what you might want to do after retirement, and talking with family and friends about plans, putting in different kind of timetable or regime for your days to make sure you're not just sat worrying about your memory would be important. And alongside that is making sure you're keeping busy during the day, so you're sleeping well at night, because sleep is so important for our physical and mental health.
We've looked at the lifestyle things. That's great. But thinking more medically now, anything we need to think about in terms of comorbidities and prescribing?
Absolutely. Really important, Sally. And this is where you GPs can help us psychiatrists out a great deal. My colleagues in the memory service tell me that sometimes they see people with presenting with memory problems, and actually it's perhaps poorly controlled diabetes
or something else that is fixable. So really helpful to review medication and review control of chronic conditions, pain, for example, as well. We know that, as we talked about, anything that's good for the heart is good for the brain. So making sure cholesterol, blood pressure, etc., are all under control would be brilliant. But saying all that, it's important to try and review polypharmacy, because tablets, medication themselves, can add to confusion. So as I'm sure you and your colleagues are keeping an eye on, trying to rationalize and reduce medications where they're not essential, avoiding sedative medications, and considering the anticholinergic effect on cognition. There's a really handy website, www.medicheck.com, at which really simply you can type in the medication patients are on, and it'll tell you whether it's likely to cause confusion and, I think, dizziness as well. So that's a really useful tool.
Great, thank you. Any odd supplements people ask you about?
Yes, all the time. People are understandably trying anything to help their brains and their memory. And more recently, I've had some really interesting questions around, gosh, cannabis oil, coconut oil, and even Marmite. And there's a brilliant fact sheets on the Alzheimer's Society, which takes an objective, non-judgmental look at these and gives people the information they need, which is usually that there's not that much evidence, unfortunately.
But Marmite's unlikely to do a lot of harm, I'm guessing.
Yes, and some people argue that it might have B12 in it, which you may need to top up on. Of course, if people are struggling with their memory, asking them whether they're remembering to take their medication, are they taking it at the right time, and are they taking it regularly? We had a lady recently referred to us who was very sleepy, and it was because she was taking a mirtazapine medication first thing in the morning and then promptly falling asleep. So that's quite an important aspect too.
Absolutely. Yes, that would make any of us feel sleepy. So what's the right time to diagnose dementia?
I still believe the answer to this question is as soon as possible, because there's so much more that can be done to support and prepare and educate somebody and their friends and family if everyone is aware of a problem early on. Now, I know there's lots of different opinions and research around early dementias and memory problems to find the right time. But the main message, I think, for your GP colleagues is don't worry about it. If there's a suspicion, if there's a concern, do what you need to do and refer in, and let the specialist services worry about whether or not to make the diagnosis and when. Just for your information, the government targets our memory clinics have to work towards are 6 weeks between referral in to diagnosis, which is tricky anyway, with or without COVID. It can take a bit longer. So just send on in as soon as possible with all the information we can possibly gather.
That's great. And most referrals will go to a memory clinic, but there are some that go in a different direction. Is that right?
Yes, I'm aware there's lots of national differences in this across the country, but most areas should have a dedicated memory clinic or memory team. And certainly in London, most of the ones I'm aware of are led by psychiatrists. There are some cognitive disorder clinics at the neurology centres. We're lucky to be linked with Queen Square, the tertiary referral centre, neurology. And we rely on them to help us with any obscure presentations, and particularly when people are under the age of 65, because they may well need some specialist tests and more in-depth assessment that we're able to offer.
So a patient comes to see me concerned about their memory, and I'd usually carry out some sort of cognitive assessment. I was really quite interested in that the NICE guidance recommended various short tools we could use, such as a 6-item cognitive impairment index and GP COG. But to be honest, I've only ever really used the mini mental state. What do you find helpful when we refer?
Yes, I agree with you. We tend to use the MMSE, mini mental state examination, most commonly, certainly as a screening tool. On our referrals, we get all sorts from our local GPs. But I agree, particularly the 6-item, the 6-sit is a little confusing, because unlike all the others, a higher score indicates a worse result. My colleagues in the memory service assure me that the GP COG is a handy, quick set of questions that are really quite practical. The other thing to say is that the memory team, when they review somebody, will repeat the test scores anyway, usually using a more in-depth tool such as the Addenbrooke's cognitive assessment test, which is scored out of 100, available in different languages, and covers various different domains of cognition that are really useful. We also sometimes use the RUDAS tool, which is a more functional test and works well with people who don't speak English as their first language, or perhaps don't have such a high level of pre-morbids or early education, and can also be done through a translator. It asks quite practical questions like getting somebody to remember a shopping list and talk us through crossing the road. I would say for your colleagues, by way of referrals, of course, it's helpful to have a cognitive screen, but the most useful information is some qualitative detail about that person's functional change. So what is it that they are struggling with day to day? What can they not do now they used to be able to do? What are their concerns and their family's concerns? And particularly, are there any risks? Are they still able to mobilise? Are they getting lost when they're out and about? Are they driving? Are there any safeguarding concerns?
Lovely, thank you. And we usually put some blood results on the bottom of our referrals, is that right?
That's wonderful. We're very pleased when we see those. In fact, our local memory service now don't accept referrals without those, so you'll be getting a letter back if they're not included. It's really helpful to have that physical screen, particularly if it's a sudden recent change. Should they be coming to the memory clinic, or really should they be seeing a geriatrician or a neurologist if there's been a sudden change in personality or cognition? Remember, it's at least a 6 month history of decline plus functional change in order to diagnose a dementia. So some routine bloods, thyroid function, B12, folate, calcium, CRP, perhaps an indication of diabetic control, HbA1c, and the all important urine dipstick to check somebody's not in the midst of a delirium rather than a dementia.
Yes, I had a lady just like that very recently who had come out of hospital, was definitely not herself, and to my considerable surprise, treating her UTI took a couple of weeks. She bounced back to baseline, which was, yes, never forget the urine infection. So our hypothetical patient comes back to us with a diagnosis of a mild cognitive impairment, MCI. We're seeing more and more of this. What does it mean, and how do you explain it to patients?
Yeah, MCI, or mild cognitive impairment, is a really commonly used descriptive sort of term rather than specifically diagnostic for someone who has noticed problems with their memory, or their family may have noticed. They might even have some deficits on a cognitive screen test, but there isn't the impact on the day-to-day functioning that qualifies them for the diagnosis of dementia per se. We've got various leaflets and information sheets about this. The Alzheimer's Society has a really good one, because it can be quite a worrying thing for people to be told. But when I reviewed some resources around this, I could see that up to 20% of people over the age of 65 reach the threshold for mild cognitive impairment. But of course, not all of those people go on to develop a dementia. It does put you at a higher risk in the general population, but MCI can be caused by simple things like urine infections we mentioned, or low mood, or other medications, transient causes that may well resolve. Saying that, it is important to keep an eye on people who have MCI, because they are at the greater risk of developing a dementia, particularly those with the amnestic MCI.
So amnestic means what in this context?
That the concern is really about forgetfulness, day-to-day forgetfulness, rather than any other aspect of cognition.
Okay, thank you. So when we keep an eye on them, what does that mean in practice?
Yeah, so most memory services, and again, this varies, I think, throughout the country, but would be advising GPs to re-refer them perhaps at 9 to 12 months. Some teams, if they're able, will keep a list and invite people back for cognitive testing after a year. I think the important thing is to empower the patients and the families to understand the term, and to encourage them to seek prompt review should they feel things are changing for that person, or impact on their day-to-day functioning is now a problem.
Excellent. And it gives the opportunity for sort of psychoeducation and information around all the good lifestyle stuff we talked about in the first section, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Lovely. So what should patients expect as a dementia diagnosis?
Well, I think it would be helpful if GPs could let patients and family know when they're being referred that it's likely to be quite a long appointment. Again, it will vary between memory clinics, but certainly ours try to do the full assessment, the cognitive test, which can take half an hour at least. And they might even do the neuroimaging or at least feedback about neuroimaging at the appointment as well. And some memory clinics have links with third sector, such as Age UK or the Alzheimer's Society, and they might, if they have a diagnosis, meet up with somebody from that charity on the day as well. So I think appointments can be quite long, or it might be that they are invited for assessments, for imaging, and then are invited back for a diagnostic and feedback appointment where they're given information and hopefully written information as well about everything that's conveyed, because there's a lot of detail to get across to somebody when they're diagnosed with the dementia.
And that's going to cover things like a lasting power of attorney and legal aspects of end-of-life care, ideally, as well, isn't it?
Ideally, yes. We're lucky we've got some really good written information, such as the Dementia Guide by the Alzheimer's Society, which we can give to people. And I tell people it's a bit of a reference book to put on their shelves and not to try and read in one go, but lots of information there. Hopefully, people will also be able to be offered some post-diagnostic education sessions for carers and family, and ideally cognitive stimulation sessions for the patients going forward, which are usually sort of weekly groups run by psychologists or OTs that help educate the patients about the dementia diagnosis and are really a fun way to get to know other people with the condition and ways to help protect and promote brain health going forward.
Excellent. And will most services keep patients on their books going forward after a dementia diagnosis, or is it a sort of diagnosis and then discharge model?
It's really variable. I know locally, unfortunately, we're only commissioned as an assessment and diagnostic service, although the team do run the cognitive stimulation therapy groups when COVID lets us. Some areas are able to keep people with dementia on their books, usually for a light touch check-in every 6 months. And the aim would be to prevent serious situations and for the people with dementia and their carers to have a point of contact check-in, which I think is brilliant if it's able to be funded, because of course this is a neurodegenerative condition. Saying that, our local team, because we do discharge people, doesn't have a waiting list. So we always say to our local GPs to refer on back to us if there's any difficulty, so we hopefully can support people in that way going forward.
So that brings us to another thing that causes a lot of problems for patients and their families, the so-called behavioural and psychological symptoms of dementia, or BPSD. How do you approach thinking about those?
Yeah, BPSD. This is a big part of my job as a community old age psychiatrist, but actually it's really hard to predict how the course of dementia will go. People often ask me at the outset, and I think if we told everybody all the possible symptoms and comorbidities that could occur, it would be rather overwhelming. But it is important to be realistic and to prepare people and to make sure they know how best to seek help should concerns arise. What we often find is that people's personalities can sort of intensify or coarsen. So if somebody was anxious pre-morbidly, they may well get more anxious, understandably so, as they recognise that they might be forgetting things, or if people are telling them such. In case anyone hasn't heard this term, BPSD, we use it as a bit of a catch-all, but basically any sort of psychiatric symptom you can think of can happen for people with dementia as it progresses. So as we've talked about, anxiety, or quite commonly depression, difficulties with sleep, agitation, restlessness, and even hallucinations and delusions. It's really hard to say what you would do to combat BPSD, because of course every person is different, every situation is different, and there's such a range of presentations. But there are really simple things, and this is where GP colleagues can help us out, because again, it's likely that people will need a physical health review, to check there's not an infection making things suddenly worse, or something simple like somebody being in pain or constipated. In fact, there was some really interesting research done about people with dementia in care homes being prescribed regular paracetamol, just 1 gram three times a day, making quite a big impact on levels of agitation and BPSD in general.
So often the people who contact us with difficulties with BPSD are the carers or the family members. Is there anything to support them?
Absolutely. And it's so important because it's very difficult sometimes to really resolve the symptom for the person with dementia. A lot of the focus needs to be on supporting the carers to manage or to get some time out so that they can then tackle the problem and support their loved one as best they can. Lots of areas of the country have access to admiral nurses who are brilliant and can give much needed advice and support to carers, or a dementia specialist nurse perhaps working with teams and memory services might be able to help. There's of course third sector support, the Dementia UK website, which organises the admiral nurses, and the Alzheimer's Society or Age UK may run memory cafes and education groups and counselling locally to support people.
Excellent. And as you've mentioned, the Alzheimer's UK website has a huge range of information. I found it very helpful. So in terms of medication, what do we do when it used to be that when someone was on something like donepezil, it had to be stopped when a person's dementia became more severe? Is that still the case?
Actually, no, Sally, I'm glad you asked that. It used to be the case, but there has been more research that shows stopping donepezil, even when someone is quite far into their illness, can be detrimental. So as long as there's not problems with swallowing it or side effects, we recommend people continue donepezil. And it's about educating families, because they might come to us and say, well, it's not working anymore. But it's letting them know that things might deteriorate further if we were to stop it. One thing we might do is to add in memantine, which is licensed for moderate to severe dementia. And we found in our practice can sometimes help with behavioural and psychological symptoms of dementia, such as agitation. Not for everybody, but it is something that's worth trying. And I understand now the NICE guidelines say GPs can go ahead and do this before consulting the psychiatry team or memory service. Although, of course, we'd be happy to give advice in that situation.
The other thing we often end up asking your teams is around the use of psychotropics. Often the question is, can you just give them something to calm them down? How do we respond to that?
Yeah, it's so tricky. I hear it all the time from carers and families that are struggling. And it's so understandable because they don't like to see their loved one distressed, of course. But I try to say to people that, look, almost any medicine that we have that will calm someone down is likely to be sedating and then may put them at risk of falls or other physical side effects. It's really important to find out what the biggest problem is. If it's around sleep, for example, before we try a medication, can we check that person is active during the day? Can they go to a day centre and keep busy so they're a bit more tired and will sleep naturally at night? Or can we use something simple like melatonin to help regulate the sleep? Or in some cases, zopiclone or even mirtazapine at low doses to improve the sleep. If it's agitation, we might use some sedating antidepressants, mirtazapine or sometimes even trazodone. For some people with perhaps not Alzheimer's dementia, but frontotemporal, we might consider low doses of SSRI such as sertraline for irritability or disinhibition. And sometimes we do try medications such as carbamazepine or pregabalin to intermittently at low doses during the day if somebody is struggling, particularly around, say, personal care and feeling very agitated and upset with that. We try to avoid benzodiazepines, but these might be needed on a PRN basis if somebody is really agitated and at risk, although of course using them regularly isn't recommended. Antipsychotics at low doses are used and are recommended by NICE for short periods in people with severe agitation that's causing extreme distress to them, or if they are aggressive or violent to others. So we do use risperidone at doses of sort of 0.25 or 0.5 milligrams and keep those under close review. As you probably know, there's an increased risk of strokes and death when using these in dementia.
Yes, so we'd only do that under secondary care advice.
Yes, usually so. And just to say, there's a really useful, nice decision tool guidance, couple of page documents online that you can print out, and we often use to explain to patients and carers the rationale and the reasons behind using medications like risperidone in dementia.
So if a patient is repeatedly asking for their mother or a deceased pet, what do we advise carers? What's the best thing to do? Is it okay to lie?
Well, there's a lot of debate about this, but from what I see in my day-to-day practice, carers usually find that they learn by experience to do this, to tell those white lies. They often tell me that disagreeing with their loved ones, trying to argue with them or reorientate them constantly, just stops being effective. The most effective carers I see work hard to step into the reality of the person with dementia and try and help them feel calmer from their perspective. Of course, it's really hard to generalize because at times going along with a person with dementia could be dangerous. For example, if they want to go out late at night or they're trying to get home. I'm constantly impressed that workarounds family and carers think of to support the person with dementia. Some people set up allotments in the garden. They bring them with them to work and give them small tasks related to their past profession so they feel they're making a difference. I see a lot of families driving around the block and announcing back home at last when their relative keeps asking to go home when they're already there. To be honest, we try not to encourage people to repeatedly reorientate them, especially if it's around trauma. If somebody's asking after a deceased loved one, to constantly remind them that they're dead can be really distressing. And instead, talking around the topic, talking about that person, what they meant to them, reminiscing about happy memories, perhaps looking at photos, would be a really good way to try and move that person on from the thinking. Although I fully appreciate, as a professional, these things are easy to say, but as a person living with somebody 24/7, it's not always easy to follow, and having a bit of time out and respite for both parties is so important.
Absolutely. Thank you. So how do you tell if someone who already has dementia is also depressed, and what do we do about it?
So yeah, I found this difficult, particularly in my training, that people often present as depressed, or other family members might bring their loved one forward saying they must be depressed because they're no longer interested in doing things, they don't want to go out, speak on the phone, they're not sleeping or eating well, they've lost weight. And sometimes it's really hard to tell, look, is this a true depression, or with it perhaps even a pseudo dementia, so people's memory is affected by their depressive illness, or is it that we're seeing the early stages of dementia, when quite understandably, if somebody's losing their confidence in speaking and losing their motivation to do things, as well happens in early stages of dementia, they might present as if it's a depression. And sometimes that's okay. We always say in psychiatry, we don't mind not knowing the answer and we'll sit with it. And it might only be in retrospect that time will tell you which one or the other it is.
So in terms of using antidepressants, what's the advice there?
So unfortunately, most research has shown us that the regular antidepressants are not particularly effective in depression associated with dementia. And that makes sense to me. And I tell my patients and carers, of course, if there's a degenerative process happening in the brain, there's less brain substance there for the medications to work on. I think mirtazapine does have some recommendation when you're thinking about anxiety in dementia, and certainly can be so helpful if someone's not sleeping or eating well. But we do sometimes use antidepressant medication, particularly if someone has a pre-morbid history of depression or anxiety. It can be really helpful. But yes, I always say, do remember that for our older adults, we have to think about the doses that we're giving people. For example, citalopram, the maximum dose for over 65s is now 20, because it can interfere with the heart rhythm, particularly the QTC.
That's a good practical prescribing point. Thank you, Claire. So thank you so much for your time, Claire. And thank you for listening to this podcast from the RCGP. Bye-bye.
Bye.